This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, D.C., a city whose location, layout, and character were all determined by the man it would be named for. George Washington supervised the creation of what was originally known as the Federal City, one of the many accomplishments of this most indispensable of the Founding Fathers. Yet, as historian Joseph Ellis argues in his new biography, we see Washington on Mount Rushmore, the dollar bill and the quarter, as cold, distant, and intimidating, as an icon rather than as a man. On a day when we try to restrain our coverage of the political battleground as the nation decides the next president, we thought it appropriate to invite Joseph Ellis to discuss our first and most important president. Later in the program, we'll take a break from politics altogether as singer and guitarist Jeff Farina joins us for a mini-concert here in Studio 3A. But first, if you have questions or insights about the life of George Washington, about his part in the Revolution, the creation of the Constitution, his presidency, about the issues of slavery, westward expansion, and relations with Native Americans, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joseph Ellis joins us from the studios of member station WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. His new book is His Excellency, George Washington. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here.
I want to begin where you end your book. You cite two eulogies delivered in the last moment before the man, as you say, was obscured by the legend. The first, Henry Lee's well-remembered summation, first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen.
Accurate? That's the one that echoes through the ages, I think. And it's a convenient way for us to recover the major reasons for Washington's exaltation and celebration. First in war, he, a year before anybody else, a year before the Declaration of Independence, stepped forward to take command of what became the Continental Army and led it for 7.5 years, never took a vacation or a furlough, and won a very improbable victory against the leading military power in the world. First in peace, he steps forward out of retirement in the 1780s to chair the Constitutional Convention, and then accepts the nearly he's voted in by acclamation almost. No one votes against him in the Electoral College, and serves two terms as president, and then steps aside from power again. He's a real aficionado of exits, and first in the hearts of his countrymen is something we don't understand. It's hard for us to grasp. At a time when the phrase United States was a plural noun and the word American still didn't translate the way we think of it now, people thought of themselves as New Englanders or Virginians. Washington became the visible embodiment of the nation. And he was the person who insisted that the creation of a separate nation called the United States was a natural consequence of the Revolution. And so he was loved in a way that I don't think he is now. I think he's like the man in the moon. He's up there. He's on the dollar bill in our wallets, but he's not really in our hearts. And while I don't want to do a celebratory biography, I do want to recover the flesh and blood human being with all his passion.
Well, that gets to the other memorable eulogy you analyzed, which was delivered by Gouverneur Morris. He described Washington as a man of tumultuous passions. Anyone who knew him, he said, could bear witness that his wrath was terrible. Yet, of course, we think of Washington as a silent, calm, the man with the gift of silence.
That's absolutely right. When his portrait was being painted by Gilbert Stuart in 1796, Stuart himself, who had an artist's eye for a person's facial personalities characteristics, said that if you came upon Washington in the forest, he would be the most savage member of the most savage tribe. And our iconic renderings of Washington are all of him as an elderly man, as a kind of safe grandfatherly figure. If we could develop a more realistic rendering of the younger Washington, if we could only go back in time and have a picture of him when he was in his 20s, he's a physical specimen and a natural athlete and a man of incredible ambition. John Adams used to say that they always picked Washington to lead them whenever they gathered together because he was always the tallest man in the room, probably about 6'3½". But I think he was also the most ambitious man in the room, the most committed to getting his way. He was a really an obsessive person in that regard, and his very potency is kind of scary, and it might be one of the reasons we sort of don't want to know about it.
Hmm. You say that this a lot of his character comes from a lifelong struggle to control those passions.
That's right. That he, that for him, driving ambition and the recognition of that ambition was the central achievement of his young manhood, as he came to realize and to begin to control it in a way that creates this image of serenity. I think that one of the reasons he has a great gift for silences is he wants to conceal from the public and maybe even from his close friends and himself the degree of his own ambition. He's a man who again violates the iconic renderings of his latter years. And there are a lot of moments, even in the cabinet meetings during his presidency, when he, really just loses it in a harangue.
Yeah, there's a famous moment during the Revolutionary War in the Battle of Monmouth when he comes across one of his generals retreating. He thought a terrible, terrible mistake, and explodes in wrath. This was Charles Lee.
That's correct. And observers said that the leaves nearly fell off the trees at the sound of Washington's voice. And he almost court-martialed Lee on the spot, but he did relieve him on the spot. And those kind of discernible leaks are, I think, clues to the deeper personality of this guy, Washington. And again, unlike Jefferson, who seems to be serene and safe and about freedom and liberty, Washington is about power and potency, about the projection of that, about the channeling of it, about the control of it. And he believed the federal government ought to have the power to coerce people to do the things that need to be done. He didn't believe that that the revolution would have been won if you depended entirely on militia, for example. Mm-hmm. So he's a believer in government power. He's a believer that government is us, not them.
He saw the revolution as a political revolution, but not the social revolution that other people saw it as.
No. I mean, it was for him, it was casting out the British and having the colonial elite replace the British. But it was something more than that, too. And here he really disagreed with the Republicans and the Anti-Federalists. He really believed that in the end, in order for the revolution to be secure, a nation need to come into existence that was more than just a confederation, that really had the power to make domestic policy. And that marks him as a different kind of creature than Jefferson. And he and Hamilton are on one side, and Jefferson and Madison are on the other.
Yeah, our number, if you'd like to join our conversation with Joseph Ellis, the author of a new biography of George Washington, His Excellency George Washington, give us a call, 800-989-8255. You can also send us email questions, TOTN@npr.org. And we'll begin, I guess, appropriately. George is calling from Roseburg, Oregon.
Thanks for putting me on the air. And first, I just wanted to say your show is a true non-biased model of democracy, so thank you for it, Neil.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. I just wanted to ask your guest, I've heard that George Washington was so loved that he could have been king of the country. And is that just a story, or how close was that? Was he really, was that really a potential, what was George's statements about that? And then also, just I wanted to make a comment, being from Pennsylvania, the Keystone State, that another George, Bush, lied and people died, but George Washington kept to his honor and didn't become king. He thought that the people were most important.
All right, let's leave today's politics out of it just for the moment, George.
Okay, sorry.
All right, go ahead, Joseph Ellis.
He's right. At the very end of the American Revolution, the last battle is Yorktown in 1781, but it takes 2 years for the treaty to get signed. During that time, the Continental Army is up in Newburgh, New York, and it's restless. And some of the officers in the Continental Army and some of the delegates to the Confederation Congress begin to talk about the prospects of making Washington king, or emperor, or whatever title he prefers, because things are going to hell in a handbasket. The economy is wrecked. The army's pay is behind. There's no provision being made for a guaranteed pension for the soldiers. So there is a conspiracy afoot, and Washington confronts it at a meeting of about 500 officers in this big building in Newburgh. and insists that any attempt to establish a military dictatorship is beyond any discussion.
And there's a wonderful dramatic moment, a theatrical moment in that speech.
That is. He takes his glasses out from his coat breast, and people have never seen him wear glasses before. It's a new pair of glasses he's got from a guy called Rittenhouse in Philadelphia. And he says, "You will forgive me, my fellow officers, but I have grown blind as well as gray in service to my country." And whatever conspiracy that there might have been successfully plotted falls apart at that real moment. George III, over in England, hears that Washington intends to reject the crown and says, if in fact he does that, he will be the greatest man in the world. Because, you see, Caesar hadn't rejected it. Cromwell hadn't rejected it. Napoleon later on will not have rejected it. Washington becomes a kind of singular figure in world history. And in fact, I think if you know, Mao didn't resist it. Lenin didn't resist it. Castro didn't resist it. The only person in the 20th century that I think fits the Washington model is Nelson Mandela, who walks away from power.
Yeah, that's great. And was he also behind the 8-year term limit, or was he influential in that whole movement, keeping president?
He did not participate in the debate in the Constitutional Convention. He was chairing it, and therefore he didn't argue. He himself, and there's a long argument about whether it should be 1 6-year term, 2 4-year terms, but he didn't argue for any limit during the actual debate, and the Constitution doesn't specify at that stage. A new constitutional amendment in the 50s does, yeah. But his decision to step down voluntarily after 8 years is his decision to score a point. And I think it's not just the two-term precedent. It's the precedent that every leader, no matter how indispensable, is disposable, mm-hmm. and that the office needs to outlive the man.
He even gets an appeal from one of his supporters to run for president again after his death.
Wow. That's right. That's right.
George,
thank you for your historical perspective. It's wonderful.
Thank you, George.
Thank you.
Let's get another caller on the line. Becky is calling from Denver, Colorado.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Becky.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I had a question regarding the religious beliefs of George Washington. It's the basic wide-held understanding that our founding fathers were trying to model our system after Judeo-Christian beliefs, but I had read a piece, obviously, that they were Masons and deists as opposed to the traditional Christian, and I'd wonder if you could speak about that.
Washington was a Mason, not a terribly active one, although the Masonic Temple right in Alexandria is this massive thing that associates Washington with the Masons. He's a kind of lukewarm Anglican. He attends church services in a local Anglican church and in Philadelphia when he's president. There is a kind of deist dimension to his thinking. He's not absolutely certain in the Christian sense that there's a heaven where your soul will go in the hereafter. And for him, the only sure form of immortality is secular immortality, the way he will live on in the memory of subsequent generations, the way we'll be talking about him on this program over 200 years later.
You do point out there is no minister there at his deathbed.
Right. In the deathbed scenes, you see prints of it in later years where he's ascending into heaven and all that. And there are no ministers there when he's dying in December of 1799. I think he was a firm believer in what he called providence. He didn't talk about God so much as he talked about providence and destiny. So that he does believe there is some kind of larger force out there that shapes our lives and that we need to align ourselves with. But it's not always an orthodox Christian doctrine.
Becky, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
And we'll have more with Joseph Ellis and his new biography of George Washington when we come back from a break. Our number, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. The email address, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On this extraordinary election day, we're talking about the one president who really had no problems with his elections, George Washington. Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Joseph Ellis is with us. His new book is His Excellency George Washington. Of course, you're invited to join the conversation. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Al, who's calling from Talkeetna, Alaska.
Yes, good morning, Neil. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment. I remember vividly in the early 70s, I was a school bus driver in Delaware, and I took a busload of kids up to Valley Forge and, of course, wandering around with the kids. And we went into the cabin that Washington had spent the winter in, and sitting up on the ledge was a set of wooden dentures. And it made Washington, for me, a very human figure.
You write a lot about his dentures, Joseph Ellis.
Yeah, those are the most famous dentures in world history, I believe. They're one of the most popular tourist objects when you go visit Mount Vernon. There are two things that everybody knows about Washington, and both of them unfortunately happen not to be true. He didn't chop down a cherry tree, and he did not have wooden teeth. He, in his lifetime, had several different kind of dentures. Different sizes and shapes made of bone and ivory and metal, and they are horrible-looking contraptions. And the last pair he had didn't fit well and somewhat embarrassed him by the way it stuck out. It made his lips protrude. So the wooden teeth that were on the mantle at Valley Forge were probably a statement about Washington in the mythological vein, but it wasn't. Well, that wasn't really the case. In one instance, this is sort of an unattractive story, but a dentist from France came to visit Mount Vernon in early 1780s, named Meilleur, I believe, who was an alleged specialist in implants. And now you can imagine how ineffective that could be with that level of science back then. But
you mean they took other people's teeth and tried to hammer them into your jaw?
Yeah, Washington asked if any of his slaves would volunteer their teeth to him, and he would pay them for them. And they pulled teeth out of his slaves and put them in his mouth.
Oh, wow.
Grizzly.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you cleared that up. I often wonder, but so they were made of, like, bone or other material?
Ivory?
Not wood.
Not wood.
Right, right. And he was very self-conscious about them.
Well, thanks for clearing that up. Good show, Neil. Thank you.
Thanks, Al.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Brian. Brian's calling from Cleveland.
Yes, this question, well, first of all, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
This question kind of follows on to the comments that you made to the last caller. Could you speak a little bit more about Washington and his slave ownership and his overall treatment of slaves? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for the call, Brian.
It's a big question. I try to spend a lot of time on that in the book. Washington, as a young man, as a planter in Mount Vernon, is a reasonably typical Virginia planter, and he's pretty numb to the moral implications of slavery. At that stage of the game, he has a little over 100 slaves. By the time he dies, he's going to have a little over 300 slaves. His experience in the North during the war began to change his mind. He experienced different attitudes there. And between 12% and 15% of the Continental Army at any given time was African American, and it was in integrated units. They were not segregated. It's the only time until the Korean War that occurred. So his view of the matter begins to change. And in the 1780s, he goes completely to the view that, in the end, slavery is incompatible with the American Revolution's values, and that he needs to find a way to either sell his slaves or free his slaves, and that the nation needs to be put on some kind of gradual slope towards the extinction of slavery. However, as president, when the opportunity to step forward on this huge issue presents itself, Washington does not do it. He fears that any direct discussion of slavery at this combustible moment, at this infancy of the Republic, puts the entire nation at risk. South Carolina and Georgia are threatened to secede if this is discussed at the national level. And so he keeps silent. In the end, In his will, written in June of 1799, and he dies in December of that year, Washington frees all the slaves he owns upon his wife's death. Of the 317 slaves, he only owns about half of them. She owns the other half from her previous marriage. And there are lots of problems with this because the slaves are intermarried in Mount Vernon, and so if you free some of them, what are you going to do with the others? But he also insists that a fund be set up to take care of the freed slaves for 25 years, and that happens. So in the end, he gets it right. He will not make you happy according to a 21st century definition of our racial values or multiculturalism, but amongst his peers, he looks pretty darn good.
Washington, of course, presided over the Constitutional Convention. How do you see his role in that convention? And the obviously the Constitution resolved it as saying slaves are counted as three-fifths of a person, which gave electoral and political advantages to the slaveholding states, which they exercised for many years thereafter.
Right. The first election that really made a difference was Jefferson's election. I think that he said nothing about slavery in the Constitutional Convention, and what was talked about at the Constitutional Convention was always sanitized, because you'll see that slavery is so huge a subject, it's the elephant in the center of the room, that they don't know how to talk about it. Slavery is not mentioned directly in the Constitution. They talk about that species of property. They invent all these circumlocutions, and I think that I don't think that it's right to say that slavery that the Constitution endorses slavery. I think that it implicitly endorses slavery in the Three-Fifths Clause and also in the clause which prevents any end of the slave trade for another 20 years. But the slave owners in the South were disappointed that the document was not more directly supportive of slavery. Meanwhile, the quasi-abolitionists in the North, in some instances, thought that the Constitution would eventually be the way in which you ended slavery. So it's a debate there. I think it's an ambiguous document.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller on the line. Jim is with us from Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Hi. I was just wondering about a book that Gore Vidal wrote about Aaron Burr, in which he presented a very unflattering portrait of George Washington's expertise on the battlefield. And your research, what has that shown about what kind of second-guessing and what kind of critique he got at the time from political leadership and newspapers and things like that?
Vidal's novel, Burr, is a great read, and he's recently written another book about all the founders, including Washington. It's a very small book, but Vidal is essentially correct about Washington as a military thinker. He lost more battles than he won. In fact, he lost more battles than any successful general in American history. He was not a great tactician. In all those battles where they were evenly matched, the British Army and the Continental Army, he was almost always outmaneuvered. And the plans that he devised were almost always too complicated to work in a kind of hectic battlefield situation. My sense is that Washington had never commanded anything more than a regiment before the Revolution. And he was good when he could see the ground and see the troops, but when the troops were out of his sight, he didn't know how to maneuver them effectively. A lot of his victories were luck, and the fact that the British who opposed him, first Howe and then Clinton and Cornwallis, were themselves not military geniuses.
Yet if he was at a disadvantage tactically, he eventually got the strategy right. He understood that
that's right.
What he needed to do was not lose.
He won when it counted.
That's right. He did. And what Neil just said is the big insight, that the British have to win, that he doesn't have to win. A lot of great generals don't get to that insight, and that's what he adopts, a kind of Fabian, they call it, strategy, and not ever putting the existence of the Continental Army at risk unless you have vast superiority, as they did at Yorktown. And if you study Yorktown, there's a new book on that. It's a miracle that that happens. Most battles are planned, and then you have to improvise. In this case, the thing fell together for Washington in a kind of marvelous, again, almost providential way. The more you study the war, the Revolutionary War, the more you realize that we were very, very fortunate.
Jim, thanks very much.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
You remind us, Joseph Ellis, how much of Washington's life as a young man was spent on the frontier in the wilderness and how much that contributed to his views about Native Americans. You say, for example, that during what we call the French and Indian War, the Seven Years' War everywhere else in the world, that he saw a struggle between three great imperial powers for control of the interior of the American continent, Great Britain, France, and the Six Nations.
That's correct. The Iroquois Confederation. It was itself an imperial power, in fact, controlled most of the ground and had been maintaining some form of hegemony or control over that entire Ohio country for the last 200 to 300 years. Washington is a realist. He knows he's got to have those Indians on his side. And he's also an unsentimental person in that he thinks that if he was in the Native American position, he would end up doing what they're doing. That would be to oppose white expansion into their own territory. You never see Washington making racial statements against Native Americans in the way that some others did. And then during his presidency, he makes some kind of sensible moral position on the Native American issue, the major domestic concern of at least his first term. He wants to create protected enclaves guaranteed by federal treaty of separate nations, Indian nations, who will be allowed to live in that area and that the waves of immigration must wash around. He fails because he can't get the Congress or the courts to support his notion of federal jurisdiction. And he also fails because it would have taken about 50,000 troops on the frontier, stretched from Great Lakes down to the Gulf of Mexico, to actually enforce it. But the last thing he writes as president is an open letter to the Cherokee Nation, hoping against hope that they will be able to be saved.
Let's get another caller on the line. Heidi is with us from Otsego, Michigan.
Hi, Neil. I was wondering, the way he was revered and people seem to want to make him king, how was he as a person? Was he approachable? you know, everybody liked him. Or was he like a mythical status at that point where they just they didn't really know much about him besides his somewhat history? And
well, the answer to that is, of course, most people never saw him in their lifetimes because they didn't have CNN back then and television, and they saw him only in portraits and prints. But they certainly had a mythological view of him, and he was, you know, again, a physical specimen who stood out. He was very aloof.
Was he a nice guy?
Pardon me?
Was he a nice guy? Was he?
No, he was not a nice guy. He was a person who you wouldn't want to work for Washington. He was a very difficult taskmaster, and there's a story, probably apocryphal, that Alexander Hamilton said to Gouverneur Morris at the Constitutional Convention, go up to George Washington, put your arm on his shoulder and say, hi, George. And when Morris did that, Washington stared him, lifted his arm off, and nobody ever did that again. There was a kind of space around Washington, an interior space that nobody else got into.
Interesting. Interesting. Thank you.
Except maybe Martha.
But he was also.
We hope she did.
You also describe after that great moment in Annapolis when he turns his sword over to the Congress and bows out, the balls afterwards, and he danced with every woman in the room.
Oh.
That's right. The women lined up to. He was a great dancer, great horseman, and a great dancer, and great graceful. A witness said that there were scores of ladies lined up, and it's a wonderful phrase, to get a touch of him. To get a touch of him. And after the ball is over, the horses come to the door, and everybody stands at the door, and Washington rides off back to Mount Vernon and you know, has surrendered his commission. I say in the book, I think it's the greatest exit in American history.
Thank you so much for the show. It's very interesting.
Thanks for the call, Heidi.
Thank you.
We're talking with Joseph Ellis about his new biography, His Excellency George Washington. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Quentin. Quentin's calling from Satsuma, Florida.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Okay.
Great show as usual.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask Joseph one thing. As a Brit, and so like I can slant it in a different way, it's like if the UK was 65 miles off the coast of United States, you know, perhaps in Virginia, Maine, or the Carolinas. Do you think that the that George Washington would have prevailed against the British if we had, like, a secure supply route? It's a bit like, you know, 3,000 miles.
How important was the distance factor in the Revolution? Yeah, go ahead.
I think it was important. The logistical problem of replacing troops and supplying them was enormous. Though the British army and the British banking system was the best in the world at doing this, I think the problem the British faced is that it's not unlike the problem the United States faces in Iraq. I mean,
correct, yeah.
After all, Washington led an insurgency there, and that it's difficult for them to identify the center of the rebellion. I mean, they captured New York, they captured Baltimore, they captured Philadelphia, they captured Charleston, but they, you know, where's the center of the rebellion? And the advantage goes to the indigenous population because they can afford to wait them out. And, you know, and in the end, public opinion back in England turns against the war, and the British simply decided the game is not worth the candle.
A lesson in history, indeed.
But indeed.
You describe a calculation he makes rather late in the war about the British Empire's ability to manufacture what I guess people call the sinews of war, and he's very depressed when he reads the result.
He does, because he thinks in the end, if it is a war of attrition over time, the British might very well win, because the British had the superior institutions, the army, the banking system, the ministerial support for the military, and the United States doesn't have that. The states refuse to meet their levies. They refuse to pay the taxes to support the army. And he thinks if we don't win it in 1781, the Continental Army might very well dissolve. So Yorktown comes in the nick of time.
Hmm. Quentin, thanks for the call.
I suppose that's like you should never have a colony on Mars.
There you go, or at least not one in rebellion anyway. One final question, Joseph Ellis, before we let you go, and that is the almost prescience that Washington seems to have about what the Revolution was about in terms of controlling what he would call the American Empire. He was looking west and not east.
That's right. I mean, that's one of the points of the farewell address, too, but he has that from the beginning. He doesn't see the Revolution in the same way that Adams and Jefferson do. They're always talking about rights and about parliaments, right to tax. And he thinks it's about power. He thinks it's about the control of the eastern third of the North American continent, and that's the future. And while the term manifest destiny hasn't gotten coined yet, that doesn't happen until the 1840s, you can see in Washington a clear sense that the future for America, at least for the next century, is going to be the consolidation of the continent. And we should look west rather than east. In fact, Lafayette asks him if he can take a world tour with him of Europe, and Washington says, no, we're not going to tour Europe. We're going to tour Detroit, the far west, and Florida. That's where the future is.
And ironically, his biggest enemy on that point was the man who would then achieve continental status, Thomas Jefferson.
Who contradicts himself.
Of course, that's another book, and of course, you've written that one as well, American Sphinx.
Thank you for that, Neil. You're very generous.
Joseph Ellis, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
Joseph Ellis is the author most recently of His Excellency George Washington, and he joined us today from the studios of member station WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts.